This is the Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Anatoly Karlin from the UNS Review, and we're going to be discussing the coronavirus and an essay he wrote on animal rights. Anatoly, it's great to have you back on the show.
Mutually so. Always good to discuss things with you, Robert.
So, Anatoly, you wrote this prediction on UNS: Corona will kill millions and crater the world economy. This was about a month ago. Can you talk about that article and which of those predictions have come true?
Well, I think as of yesterday, the part about the economy is self-explanatory. I mean, either you can start setting up quarantines, which will indeed have major negative feedbacks into the world economy, or you can just let the disease run its course, in which case, according to predictions by qualified epidemiologists, up to 70% of the world population may get the new coronavirus. With a mortality rate of around 1-2%, I mean, that's just basic arithmetic from that point, that it's going to be at least in the millions.
As things are now, do you see it continuing to accelerate, or do you see some kind of stabilization? I know in looks like South Korea, they're starting to stabilize. There's speculation that China is stabilizing now. That doesn't seem to be the case in the United States.
Well, I mean, the good thing about Wuhan is that China has proved that you can actually control the virus at any date for some point in time. It still remains to be seen whether it will be sustainable. What China is doing is the world's largest quarantine by far that's ever been seen on the face of this planet. According to the statistics, in February, only car sales collapsed by 96% relative to the same period last year. That's not a gaffe, that's 96%. Flights are down by 80%, and shipping appears to be down by a third. So, these are huge numbers. They're basically seem to be comparable, if not worse, to the numbers seen in the Great Recession in 2008 to 2009. How sustainable that is, I'm not sure. I mean, eventually the quarantine will have to be loosened, and we'll see if R0 goes above one at that point, or whether it can remain below one.
Yeah, in those countries, China is much more authoritarian in the way the economy is structured. They can have a quarantine because of basically neoliberalism and how dependent our economy is on trade. The incentive is against any kind of quarantine. I mean, I predict it's probably going to get much worse before any kind of serious quarantine happens.
I mean, I think that's obvious, and ultimately, the Americans, they're the prisoners of electoral politics because, it's easy to make Trump, I think a lot of people have been doing that. But on the other hand, what choice does he have? He can either start like doing hardcore quarantines, in which case the economy goes collapses, he'll get blamed for that. Or he can let COVID rage through the US and then be blamed for the hundreds of thousands of deaths, of senseless deaths that will result from that. So you can't really win.
Yeah, with Trump, either way, either if there's a quarantine, the economy crashes even further, or if it gets out of control, either way, it's a bad scenario for Trump's re-election. I will say it was a major missed opportunity to tie the virus towards open borders and globalism. You would think like the original 2016 Trump would have, but all Trump really said is he was just talking about the stock market. That was a missed opportunity.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, that's like the Blump meme, right?
Yeah. I know Tucker Carlson's been talking about this, how significant is the problem of the United States, and I'm sure other countries as well, being dependent upon China for medical supplies?
I think that's, a potential problem. The U.S. does have a massive pharmaceuticals industry, so, if you have, national decision-making at the levels of power, then I assume that it should be pretty easy for the U.S. to produce its own medicines. But whether we'll get to see that sort of competence, well, to date, the record hasn't been encouraging.
And it could very well turbocharge trade war.
Yeah, I think so. I predicted that there'll be a growing, that perhaps Trump's major lasting legacy to world geopolitics will actually be what I call the great bifurcation between the Sinosphere, which is the region of the world dominated by the Chinese economic influence, and the Western Sphere, which will, just by the sheer preponderance of the U.S. relative to Western Europe, individual West European countries, will be dominated by the U.S. And it seems, I do think that the coronavirus will accelerate these trends.
And I've been sympathetic to Bernie Sanders in the past, but Bernie's response was incredibly weak. He said that he would not consider shutting down the border under any circumstance.
Mm-hmm. He's the prisoner of the identity politics people who've barged into the Democratic Party since 2016, because, we all know how just 5 years ago he was talking about how open borders is a core proposal. Well, he went with the SJWs. I don't know if that bet will pay off, but, based on Super Tuesday, it seems that he's fucked.
He went too far in the woke direction, and I talked about that on my last show with Brandon Adamson. A big issue is for a lot of these lower wage service sector jobs is a lot of employees, like things like jobs like at supermarkets and fast food, is a lot of those companies won't give their employees paid leave, so they'll be at major risks, and if they quit their jobs, mm-hmm. they could become unemployed. So that's a really powerful economic incentive. Some people have been floating the idea around about a UBI pilot program to help people self-quarantine.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, obviously. All of these ideas would obviously be very useful right now. But, in one of my first posts about the coronavirus, I started posting about it in January. I sort of speculated about the different advantages and disadvantages that the U.S. Would have relative to, say, Europe or China. So one of the things I noted as being good for the U.S. is that it's got a very car-centric culture, which is good because cars have fewer people in them than public transport, and it's also full of suburbia, so it has got that going for it. On the other hand, the big negative is, of course, the culture that you're expected to come to work, even if you're like coughing like mad and spreading germs everywhere, and it seems that companies headed by normie directors who don't appreciate the risks of COVID won't take reasonable precautions. Not just humanitarian ones, but just like if you're concerned about the profits of your company, then it's better to give somebody sick leave for a month than to have them continue come in and then infect your whole department and have them out of order for a month, perhaps a couple of them die. But I'm not very optimistic on that account. I mean, as you correctly pointed out, the vast majority of countries have sick leave, at least 14 days a year, which the employer is obligated to pay at full wages or almost full wages.
It's interesting because a lot of social trends that we've discussed, things like suburbanization and social atomization, there generally aren't, in a lot of ways, they're negative trends, but that kind of lifestyle, like a person living, someone who's more socially atomized, needs, and just middle class suburbanites, those kind of lifestyles will be lower risk. And people with higher levels of social capital, or kind of environments like where you have in Europe, where there's much more communal space, because I remember when I was in Milan, like it did seem much more densely populated than the United States, so I could definitely see why there would be much higher risk.
Well, I mean, I think it seems that the graphs, there's been graphs going about, and it seems that the epidemic exploded in Italy a bit earlier than in the rest of Europe and the US, but the graphs seem to be broadly similar. And of course, we all appreciate that the US is underestimated, grossly underestimated, because as of a few days ago, the US has only done 6,000 tests versus 150,000 in South Korea, just to give an example, and also factor in the US population being six times as big as South Korea's.
Were a lot of the nations too slow to restrict travel from China?
Well, I think that's probably true. Obviously you'd slow down the arrival of the epidemic by closing it down. I mean, how realistic it is to filter out all cases without becoming best Korea, I'm not sure whether that's indeed possible. Perhaps it might have been possible for the communist bloc before 1991, but today I think there's very few countries which can do that.
And there were all these cases with APAC, CPAC, and NATO, and a lot of people on Twitter kind of are joking about it as like a punishment. But the thing is, just looking at it from a practical standpoint, if those people are going to these meetings and interacting with so many people on a regular basis, traveling around, then that kind of lifestyle just puts them at risk. And you see that with a lot of people within the establishment.
Well, yeah, I mean, actually, ironically, it will affect the jet set people who go to conferences everywhere and who need to network really hard. They'd probably be really hard hit.
Besides the obvious, which is the elderly, which demographic groups are the most and least vulnerable within the United States?
I mean, there were some theories most energetically propounded by a guy called Lance Walton, who died for the Unstview. He was for a long time arguing that COVID, that East Asians are much more vulnerable to COVID-19 for genetic reasons than whites. And I was always pretty skeptical about that, because the main study on which it's based, it's got a sample size of literally 8 people and 1 Asian. And I think since then it's been pretty conclusively disproved. The mortality rates in Italy are much worse than in South Korea, actually. But that probably has more to do with just the basic fact that in Italy, it's I think it's literally the world's oldest population.
Oh yeah, that race-specific theory, the ethnic-specific theory about Asians being more susceptible, that was going around in the beginning, but then after it spread.
Yeah.
Also, it spread.
Yeah,
but pretty bad, and they're not. That would.
Yeah, but hey, actually, Lance Walton is still pushing that theory, believe it or not.
Yeah, besides the race-specific theory, I thought about that, but I'm pretty skeptical of that at that time. As far as like lifestyle, which demographics are more at risk? Obviously, urban versus suburban, of course, but based on like lifestyle.
I mean, in terms of killing people, I think the biggest factor by far is age, because based on the statistics, which which have been appearing on Twitter on the in the academic journals, it's 0.2% for people under the age of 45. And then it rises to 4% for 60-year-olds, 8% for 70s, people in their 70s, and up to 15% for people in their 80s and older. People are saying that, like small brain people, in my opinion, are saying that, oh, well, who cares, like 0.2%, who doesn't seem very high. But if you do the calculations, which I did, that's the equivalent, like even 0.2%, which is what people like me or you are risking. That's the equivalent of taking down 500 flights in a Boeing 737 MAX in a single year. So, like, would you take 500 flights in a 737 MAX? I would not be happy about that.
No, no. You wrote about Russia's handling. Will Russia succumb to Corona-chan? What are your thoughts on how Russia's handled the situation?
I don't uncritically place Russia on all things, but I think it's actually not doing too badly, because it seems to have put up travel restrictions on China relatively early. I mean, it still hasn't stopped the coronavirus. As of a couple of days ago, there were already 17 cases. But at least there's been already quarantines. Practically all of the cases which have been starting up in recent days, they are from Italy, not from China. So that's one evidence that China has, at least for the time being, controlled the epidemic, is that all the international cases are now either from Iran or from Italy. Anyway, there's been some quarantines, people who are arriving from countries with a big corona risk, so which includes Italy, Iran, the US now, they have to submit to a 14-day quarantine at home, and the police have the authority to check up on them. So if they walk away, then that could potentially be detected. And there's also, Moscow at least has formulated some plans. So if the situation continues getting worse, there'd be progressively more and more restrictions. So up to the measures we've seen in Wuhan. So total restrictions on transport in and out of Moscow, and shutting down schools, gyms, shopping centers, public transport, and so on.
You're in Moscow, which is a major city. I haven't been in LA in a while, so I'm outside of the major city. But have you noticed a big decline in big crowds?
No, I don't think there's been any significant effect other than the absence of N95 masks in online shops. I mean, they vanished about a month ago. Only perhaps 2-3% of people are wearing masks, not proper masks, like those shitty medical masks that don't really do anything. But yeah, something like 2-3% of people are wearing them in the metro, and the Chinese restaurants are empty. But apart from that, I haven't.
Yeah, I noticed that there a lot of Chinese restaurants are not getting any business, and there's all these woke news segments trying to say it's racist.
Yeah, I mean, ironically enough, actually, I think it might well actually be. It sounds counterintuitive, but I actually suspect that it's safer to dine at the Chinese restaurant now than elsewhere, because A, it will be empty, and B, because China has at least temporarily controlled its epidemic, so it's not really emitting much in the way of infectees. Whereas Italians, Iranians, probably soon Germans, Spaniards, Americans, they will be.
I haven't really seen the specific statistics, so it's silly to say, to play the race card about it and to say it's racist or xenophobic to blame it on China, but I am interested in just looking at the practical statistics. So looking at the United States, what actual percentage of cases is tied to with people who are maybe of a Chinese background or have ties to China, and what cases just sort of Americans in general who are just primarily the people part of the jet set crowd?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that the vast majority of cases, including the American outbreaks and the outbreaks in Italy, were carried over by Chinese people. So the I've read by a Moldbug man, he's a funny guy on Twitter, that Northern Italy, I think Milan, has a pretty large Chinese community, and they actually dominate the fashion, like, you know, those fancy handbags that they sue. It's mostly Chinese actually now. That was a surprise to me, but apparently that's the case. So these Chinese communities first spread it amongst themselves, and then it went out into the wider population, and now you're seeing these outbreaks. I mean, obviously, that's also the case in the US, because there's Chinese Americans, that's 2% of the population. They obviously have intense travel links with China. The US travel links, like the intensity of US travel links with China, actually about five times as intense as the EU's. So it's actually mildly surprising that it was in Italy that was the epicenter in the West. But I mean, there's a major random element to it, because I mean, if you get a super spreader in the early stages, then I mean, that's going to kick the whole thing forward by a week or so.
Was it Robin Hanson who suggested that paying young people to purposely get infected and it would produce very few casualties, but also push?
I mean, yeah, he suggested, actually what Hansen suggested is infecting people in general gradually, so that there's, I mean, the main danger is that you have a spike and there's only a certain number of intensive care units that countries have. And if there's a surge of cases in, early on, which overwhelms the healthcare system, then the mortality rate will rise from 1% to 4 or 5%, which is obviously something that you really want to try to avoid. So, I mean, I think his idea makes sense. That particular thing about paying young people to infect themselves in particular was actually my addition. I mean, there's first, yeah, they're much more likely to survive. But another factor is that young people tend to be more out and about than older people. So if you have more people who are out and about, who are not infected, who already have immunity, then that's going to suppress the R0 rate, I think, to a great extent than if it was just totally random.
You wrote Cucked by Corona, and will Corona have a non-trivial impact on global fertility?
Yeah, there's some... This was brought to my attention by a guy called Wael Tayej Miller. He's on Twitter and blogger, tweets as a co-evolutionist. That he was the guy who brought it to my attention. And yeah, the basic idea is that there's a large amount of ACE2 receptors, which is what the coronavirus attaches itself to in the testes, amongst other organs. So there's there might be a particular risk to male fertility on that account. And apparently, according to him, he speaks fluent Chinese and reads Chinese. There's been quite a lot of papers already in the Chinese, academic community about this.
And before we move on to our next topic, is there anything else you'd like to add about Corona?
Some genetic things. About washing your hands and making sure you have a good stock of food, although that's always useful to have, but it's never too late. And do try to get some N95 masks. One thing I've heard, it's to extend their lifetime, you should, after using them, put them in a Ziploc bag to avoid dust continuing to get in. Because they're pretty expensive now, so you might want to and also get a close-fitting goggles or a ski mask, perhaps, because coronavirus can come in by the eyes just as easily as by the respiratory tract, apparently.
So you wrote this article about a year ago, The Cognitive Chain of Being, A New Approach to Animal Rights. You measure the issue of animal rights and the consumption of meat and dairy in mathematical terms rather than simply as a moral issue?
Yes.
What is the origin of that concept?
So basically, as you know, as many of my readers and listeners know, I spent 10 years in the Bay Area. So during that time, I was pretty active amongst the transhumanist people, the nationalist people, and the effective altruism people. So as you know, the sort of main shtick is quantifying suffering in a, well, they try to do it in a sort of scientific or semi-scientific way instead of just arbitrarily, and figuring out the most cost-effective ways of reducing that net suffering. And one of the main sort of vectors of EA's sort of research is the question of animal diets and how to reduce animal suffering. And one thing I noticed, however, is that a lot of them didn't seem to be adjusting for the intellectual capacity of different animals. Because it always seemed to be quite intuitive to me that the greater the brain mass of an animal, the more its capacity for suffering. I mean, that seems to be pretty intuitive, but there's also some concrete recent research that gives credence to this intuition, in my opinion. So, because the latest series, academic theories of consciousness, they revolve around the concept of information integration, whereas information integration is itself tightly coupled to intelligence. And intelligence, in turn, can often be measured by things such as brain size, encephalization quotient, neuronal density, and other things such as some animals can be taught vocabulary. They have different ranges of vocabulary that they can learn. Humans can learn 100,000 words. The gorillas can learn 1,000 words. The very brightest border collies can learn 1,000 words, just like the average gorilla. So there's a lot of these different tests, and I mean, I think there's a lot more research to be done. But I think quantifying animal intelligence is possible, just like it has been done with humans. There's been a G factor found for a wide range of non-human animals by now, such as for dogs and even for some species of fish even. I think it's something that should be developed by serious academics instead of just on a sort of popular blog.
And you have a chart that ranks different food items based on the amount of suffering. So for people who are not willing to become totally vegan, which I don't think it's not realistic to convince everyone to be vegan. You do have like a ranking. Can you briefly go over the ranking from like fish, chicken, red meat, and dairy products?
I mean, in theory, it's possible to be vegan, but if you supplement with vitamin B12, but obviously the vast majority of people are not going to do it, and I don't think it's going to be healthy in the long term, whatever people say, because even vegetarians have been found to have higher rates of mental illnesses than people who, like, relative to the baseline. So perhaps some people which seem to be more adapted to vegetarianism, such as Indians, perhaps they could manage that, but North Europeans would have more deleterious effects from that. I agree with that, and I think the main considerations should be in traditional effective altruist considerations, they just look at things such as the mass of an animal and how much meat it generates, but don't really take into account intelligence when quantifying their suffering. So according to them, beef would probably be really ethical, relatively ethical, whereas you really should try to avoid something like catfish or salmon, because you need to. They also quantify something called the number of days of life equivalent to pain of death, and because some people, some animals have longer lifespans, so if they only have to suffer for, so if they live less, then that sort of translates into more suffering relative to the lifespan. So according to these traditional calculations, something like eating catfish would appear to be very unethical, which doesn't seem to be very plausible to me, because catfish are just like these really primitive creatures, whereas, say, pigs, they are actually pretty complex animals who seem to have personalities that are comparable to dogs. Well, I mean, in the complexity of their personalities and their intelligence and so on. So in my personal opinion, probably, like if you were to compile an ethical ranking, probably best to abstain from pork, and then abstain from chicken, then abstain from beef, and then abstain from fish. Well, I mean, everybody will choose some sort of an arbitrary position in that hierarchy.
And by fish, you're differentiating different types of fish. So how would you rank, like, salmon, catfish, tuna?
Well, I mean, I don't really know, to be honest, about their relative intelligence levels. I mean, I would assume they'd be pretty similar to each other at a very low level, because, I mean, fish have very low numbers of neurons, and they seem to be behaviorally very simple creatures.
Do you think it makes any logical sense for someone to be vegetarian but then still eat dairy?
Yes, because as I understand, the definition of vegetarianism is that you can eat both dairy products and eggs. It's only vegans who don't eat dairy or eggs.
Well, the thing with eggs, they kill all the male chickens when they're born, so in a sense, eating eggs is just the equivalent of eating meat.
Well, of course.
There's been talk of banning that, but I'm not really some countries have discussed banning that.
I mean, to be honest, I mean, it's just because these small chicks are just really cute. But approaching it with the ruthless, clear-mindedness of this sort of cognitive chain of being approach, chickens aren't very complex, and chicks are going to be extremely simple, so probably not a big deal in the grand picture.
The visual image is appalling of watching the videos. But
obviously, there's the cute factor.
But as far as the long-term suffering, there's more suffering if they're raised to adulthood and then used for meat.
Oh, they're killed in like 2 seconds. So, it doesn't seem to be too like bad relative to like slaughtering full-grown pigs after they're kept in pretty like tight coops for most of their lives.
Yeah, so you're not really going to convince large numbers of people to become vegan, but I do think one issue mentioned a lot in the transhumanist scene is artificial meats, in vitro meats could become a big thing in the future.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not trying to convince anybody to become a vegan, obviously. I'm just saying that if you're sort of concerned about reducing animal suffering, then in my opinion, the optimal way of going about it is to take these cognitive factors into consideration. And personally, I eat beef and I eat chicken. I don't eat pork. So, I mean, that's where I arbitrarily draw the line.
Do you see in vitro meat taking off?
It's not really something I follow closely. As far as I know, it's still much more expensive than normal meat. I mean, it seems like the dominant trend right now is to try to make meat substitutes, although, I've already managed to try these sort of meat substitutes. There's a Russian chain called Terimok, which, 10 of their outlets made an experiment serving those meat-free burgers, but they don't really taste anything like meat, in my opinion. I think that those people who died that they that they taste like meat have been paid off by Big Soy, frankly.
A lot of animal rights activists, they talk about like winning over the masses, but do you see people who are willing to make like personal sacrifices for animal rights, do you see it as a kind of a small niche of personality types?
Yeah, I mean, from my observations, actually, the main impulse to reduce meat consumption has actually come not from any considerations about animal suffering, but from the global warming hysteria that's become really big in the past 2 years, alongside the rise of Greta Thunberg and all those scare stories about the methane clathrate gun going off and stuff like that. So it's not something I honestly expected. I did expect a sort of shift, a sort of moral campaign to shift away from meat towards vegetarianism, perhaps when artificial meat becomes cost competitive, say in like mid-century. I didn't expect it to begin right now, where countries like Germany are now discussing the prospect of just taxing that meat or even banning it. I don't think it's going to be very popular at all, though. I mean, it's obviously something like green voting liberals in urban areas, sweeplies support, but it's going to, just like fuel taxes, it's going to hit the sort of pros, the blue-collar workers hardest, and they already have this perception that the elites are out to get them. And if you make meat much more expensive for them, because they're poorer, they're the ones who are going to be like sort of hit the most by that. Then of course you'll just feed the same populism that's been gaining political ascendancy in Western Europe and the U.S. in the past 5 years.
Yeah, if you were to outlaw factory farming and dramatically improve the conditions, there would be an increase in the cost of meats and dairy. And the thing is there's a segment of the population that is willing to spend more, but it's a more kind of elite. It's an elitist position because you have like a group that is more socially conscious about this, and they're imposing their will on the masses.
They also have the money to afford meat anyway if they wanted to, and shop and go to restaurants and have nice vegetarian meals and stuff like that, which blue collar workers, they don't have the money or the time for that, obviously. So
people who eat at fast food, they benefit having the cheaper cost of meat. And the thing about eating vegetarian or vegan is there's a lot of great food that's gourmet, but if you're on a budget, then the food you're going to be eating is going to be more bland unless you're really creative.
Yeah, obviously. So vegetables are pretty expensive. I mean, even relative to meat, certainly relative to caloric value. So
what are trends that you predict taking off as far as these issues? Do you think there will be really stricter regulations, and then you see the cost of food going up? Do you see there's some kind of a technology being used to adapt to these trends, or do you think there'll be too much of like a populist backlash?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty simple. I think that the countries where they sort of sweeplies and green sort of people have a preponderance, such as Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden, I imagine, they're going to have these experiments, and the countries where people don't care about these issues, such as Eastern Europe, they're obviously not going to be taxing meat anytime soon, perhaps that's another factor which will make them relatively more attractive for people relative to Western Europe over time. Just as a fact, obviously meat is access to affordable meat is not a big factor right now, or a factor at all, but who knows, it might be in another decade or two.
Do you think there's an HBD factor for concerns for animal rights?
Probably not a big one, because I think the main difference, I've written a lot about that, is actually the sort of the east-west division of Europe between the communist bloc and the NATO, the American-influenced bloc. Because if you look at things like support of gay marriage, for instance, yeah, I mean, somebody like A.E. Jayman will claim that it's these sort of North European weirdos who support it more than anybody else. But if you actually look at the map, then the major division is not between the Hainal areas and the non-Hainal areas, but between the countries which were exposed to American influence and the ones where sort of antediluvian social attitudes were preserved by what I like to call the Soviet freezer. I mean, the Soviet Union, the communists imposed their new ideology, but at the same time, the sort of like social attitudes from the like the 50s were basically preserved, like deep frozen. Whereas in Western Europe, you had these sort of radical ideas filtering mostly from American universities about racism, microaggressions, BLM, gender feminism as opposed to equity feminism. You had all these ideas being generated, and they just kept getting more and more radical over time. And I think that this sort of hysteria over Mita, the small hysteria about Mitas causing the world to as causing global warming, that's just one sort of element in this sort of general pattern.
How much does meat consumption actually contribute to climate change?
I don't think it contributes a lot, because if you actually look, a lot of the areas which are used to be, I mean you still need animals to fertilize like a normal agriculture, and a lot of the areas which can't support which are used for livestock grazing, they would not make for very productive agricultural areas anyway. Frankly, the contribution of livestock farming to global warming has been very much exaggerated for political reasons.
We're getting close to the end of the show. On a different topic, do you have any thoughts on the U.S. presidential election?
I mean, we'll see today, right? There's voting going on. I think that if Bernie can't even get Michigan, I think it's pretty obvious that he's done. And I mean, the polls are pretty pessimistic. He's tailing Biden by an average of something like 20 percentage points in Michigan. And I just opened electionbettingodds.com, and he's got a just a 5.6% chance of getting the nomination as of right now, with Biden at 89%. Well, I mean, what can I say? The two geriatrics with varying levels of dementia are going to be battling for the U.S. presidency over the next few months, and one of them will win, so good luck with that.
And you're not necessarily super supportive of any of the candidates?
Well, I mean, I like Trump, and for that matter, Sanders a lot more than Biden. And I actually liked Bloomberg even over Biden. I mean, Biden, first of all, he's a total normie, and I just dislike normies in general.
Bloomberg, at least, is honest about that he's an elitist.
Biden he's a ruthless technocrat, yeah.
Yeah, but Biden's so obsessed with proving that he's one of the people.
I mean, yeah, having Bloomberg as president would give the U.S. a sort of cyberpunk vibe. But Biden wouldn't even do that. It's just like a lamer version of the Soviet Politburo, where he doesn't even make any of the decisions. Frankly, he'll be like Chernenko, who's somebody who nobody cares about because he died after 6 months in office. Well, I mean, Biden, because of the better medical care, will probably be drooling away, and actual policy will be done by the Wall Street people who encircle him, the liberal interventionists who run the foreign policy. I'm sure that that Hillary Clinton will call back, maybe become Secretary of State, Samantha Power, you know, the humanitarian interventionists, they'll just ride all over him while he rules in his chair. That's what I think will happen if he'll win. And I fully imagine that he has an excellent chance of winning against Trump, because there's the entire clusterfuck over Corona, which he's responding to very badly, very incompetently. It's basically a slow-burning Katrina, in my opinion, in terms of the public perception of the response. And secondly, obviously, the global economic collapse. Not collapse, but the global recession, which now seems to be close to inevitable.
Yeah, and basically what we said at the beginning of the show, towards the beginning, as Trump is screwed either way, if he does quarantine, that will crash the economy further. But then if he doesn't do anything, Corona will get worse. So, yeah, the whole situation will look pretty bad for his reelection, no matter what happens.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, stranger things have happened. I mean, I'm not writing out Bernie entirely, because, I mean, in 2016, I've read that he was something like 20 points behind Hillary Clinton in the polls in Michigan, that then actually ended up winning Michigan. So there's some chance that he'll repeat it. Who knows? But although it does seem pretty unlikely, because, I mean, he swapped his sort of former base of blue-collar workers and all the rural people who like their guns for SJWs, basically. So probably that I imagine that bet is not going to work out for him, but who knows. We'll see the day after tomorrow.
Anatoly Karlin, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Okay, yeah, thank you. But see you later.